This is Marketplace Money for the week of January 15th, 2010. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam, a world of investing.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is Marketplace Money. I joked early on in the housing crisis that we should start calling ourselves Marketplace Mortgage. Well, here we are many moons later, and let's talk mortgage loans, shall we? First, the good stuff. Mortgage interest rates are falling again. The average for a 30-year fixed is down to just a skosh over 5%. That's pretty good. And now the bad stuff. All those terrible, horrible, no good, very bad home loans that some lenders doled out like Tootsie Rolls. Well, this week, federal authorities announced a slew of subpoenas to mortgage companies with high rates of bad loans. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has the details.
The folks at Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, are cracking down on mortgage fraud. They want 15 mortgage companies to explain why their loans failed. The government picked up the tab for those bad loans because they were covered by federal mortgage insurance. Anthony Sanders is professor of finance at George Mason University.
They have not yet documented that these people have committed any sort of crime. However, when they see unusually large default rates, they want to know why. And as taxpayers, we should be very happy they're looking into this. My worst fear would be that they didn't.
In the last few years, the Federal Housing Administration, or FHA, has helped prop up the housing industry after subprime lending dried up. It went from backing 3% of new home loans to around 30% today. Barry Zigas follows housing issues for the advocacy group Consumer Federation of America. He says that higher volume is harder to police.
The department is extremely worried that they will become the dumping ground for bad loans that might otherwise in the past have gone into the subprime market.
The FHA doesn't actually make loans. Zigas says it insures mortgages, offering the lender protection from failed loans.
And that means that if it fails, FHA will pay off whoever owns the mortgage.
Historically, the FHA has not had to rely on taxpayers for funding. Stuart Gabriel is professor of finance at UCLA's Anderson School of Management.
They are self-sustaining based on their insurance fund. They charge their borrowers insurance premia, and those premia are used to defray the cost of default on those small percentage of mortgages that go into default.
But Gabriel says the number of defaults over the last 2 years have been climbing.
Today, there are looming and very significant question marks as to whether the insurance fund will be adequate in the near term, because the losses in terms of default on newly originated FHA-insured mortgages have been so significant.
With so many failed loans, Gabriel says the FHA's solvency is in question.
There is a very significant possibility that this particular government program, for the first time in its history, will require the taxpayer to write a check.
To protect the FHA, many observers say it must raise mortgage down payments. Traditionally, FHA-backed loans require just 3% down or less. Again, George Mason finance professor Anthony Sanders.
If you have 3.5% or 0% down loans, it can get kind of dangerous out there because the incentive for fraud increases dramatically.
Sanders and other housing experts suggest raising the down payment as high as 10%. That would make it harder for consumers to afford homes, but it would also give them a big enough financial stake in the home to keep them from walking away if the house price falls. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This week marked the start of Wall Street bonus season. It's a great time for their bank accounts, but not for their public image. Many Americans wonder how anyone could deserve 7- and 8-figure bonuses so soon after the near collapse of the banking system. But what can you do about it other than snarl, right? Well, for starters, you could switch banks. And joining us to talk about a fledgling movement to get more folks to do just that is Arianna Huffington, she of the Huffington Post. Welcome to Marketplace Money.
Hi.
So a couple of weeks ago, you posted on the site sort of a call to arms for anyone who banks with one of the big kahunas. It's called Move Your Money. Tell us a little bit about this campaign.
So it all started over dinner with friends. We were all talking about this huge irony of the taxpayer bailing out the big banks. And now the big banks are doing very well. They're making massive profits. They're giving themselves huge bonuses, while Main Street is suffering with double-digit unemployment, foreclosures, bankruptcies, etc. So we teamed up with the IRA, Institutional Risk Analytics, to provide a tool that we made available on a site that we called moveyourmoney.info. So anyone who wanted to move their money could actually just put their zip code in and find out the creditworthy, solvent community banks in their neighborhood so that they could find a credit union or a community bank and move their money from one of the big banks.
And how's it going so far?
In the few days since we've launched the campaign, well over half of the country's zip codes have already been searched. And the comments that people are leaving and the action they are taking is an incredible indication of how much people really wanted to move from resignation and anger to action.
But even if you do get a lot of people to switch to community banks, do you really think it'll put much of a dent in the big banks' bottom line?
Well, it actually makes a big difference because the core deposits that banks rely on are very important to their bottom line. Just to give you an idea, this year alone, banks are expected to make $38 billion, the big banks, on overdraft fees. And instead of lending, which if you go back, you will remember that was the primary reason supposedly we had to save them in order to be able to lend again and start the positive economic cycle that we're all looking for. Instead of doing that, they use the money to fatten their balance sheets and go back to the risky derivatives trading.
It sounds like perhaps your real goal here is empowerment for folks who are so angry right now, even more than damaging those big banks.
Our goal is not to damage the big banks. Our goal is to make them smaller. And we believe that making them smaller is entirely in the interest of this country. In fact, keeping them too big to fail undermines our financial security in the future.
All right. Well, we described this earlier as a fledgling movement. We'll be interested to see whether it turns into something bigger. Arianna Huffington is co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post, where you can find all kinds of information on the Move Your Money campaign. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
But perhaps you know you've more than a fledgling campaign on your hands when Stephen Colbert, or at least his TV persona, takes a pot shot at you in his nightly news parody, The Colbert Report.
The idea of a community bank presupposes that we still have communities.
Yeah, which is a big leap.
We don't really have communities anymore. Because I just stay in my home and I do all my banking online and I pay my bills and I play Mafia Wars on the other side of the screen. But my local bank isn't going to provide that for me.
Well, shall we continue with the outrage? Seems to be all the rage these days, so let's reach into the Marketplace Money mailbox for some of your comments on our recent coverage. Last month, you may remember, we gathered up a group of our favorite contributors to take a year-end look at personal finance. How'd we all do in 2009? And they had some tough love for all of us in reviewing the economic collapse. Here's one comment that was made by Knight Kiplinger.
The crisis was born of many, many factors, including bad habits of all of us collectively, the American people.
Well, that made Jim Harkness of Minneapolis mad as hell, and he's not going to take it anymore.
I am livid after listening to your smug, patronizing panel of so-called experts use words like scapegoating to refer to the legitimate anger of ordinary Americans toward the Wall Street execs who both created and profited from last year's crash. Shame on them all for implying a moral equivalence between individual homeowners who took risky loans and are now in foreclosure and firms like Goldman Sachs that destroyed the lives of millions of Americans and have never been held accountable.
We are all for accountability, and that's what intrigued us about the Hildebrandt family of New Richmond, Wisconsin. They got an award from the National Federation for Credit Counseling earlier in the year after climbing out of a $100,000 hole in just 4 years. So we checked back in with them around Christmas time. Many of you applauded their efforts and said they were an example to those wanting to turn their finances around. Others of you, not so much. Here's Cynthia Dunbar of Princeton, Massachusetts.
I don't understand why someone should receive an award because they racked up $100,000 worth of debt and paid it back. Why and how did they get themselves into such a hole? What about an award for people who use moderation, spend within their means, and pay their bills on time?
Well, you can find out how they got into that hole by listening to our first interview with them back in September. Meanwhile, a lot of you wrote in about April Lunston's story on adults moving back in with their parents, so-called boomerang kids, because of the economy. Meg Weideman-DeWall of Chelsea, Michigan, was excited to hear her kids weren't alone.
Thank you so much for this story. My 22-year-old daughter and 24-year-old son are both living with relatives for free and feeling like losers. In Europe, this is not so uncommon. Here in the United States, we make kids feel bad about living at home. Not only is it a responsible and practical thing to do, it takes maturity to face your peers when you have to move back home.
But Stephen Rojak in Texas was not about to lay out the welcome mat. He writes, I cannot agree with the decision not to charge the adult child a token rent payment. It's the wrong message to allow an adult child to live at home for free. And finally, a green-conscious listener thinks I was sending the wrong message when I described one of my New Year's traditions. I burn old financial documents in my fireplace at the end of the year. Out with the old, in with the new, I say. But Mary Pohl of Tallahassee, Florida, thinks I should leave that ritual in the past as well. Fireplace fires are the number one source of pollution in neighborhoods, she writes. There is dioxin from burning organic substances, plus particulate matter from the smoke. These are both highly toxic. May I suggest you shred and recycle the paper? Thank you, Mary. I will take that under advisement. If you'd like to set fire to one of our segments, or think one of our stories should have been tossed in the recycling bin, do send us a letter. Go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says contact. Healthcare reform, done right, will change the way we take care of ourselves. And if passed, it could even affect how we make major life decisions.
Healthcare legislation could also get rid of job lock. That's when folks stay at a job they can't stand because they need to keep their family insured.
That's coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Could it be? Is it possible? Will we actually get some sort of healthcare reform signed? There was a marathon negotiating session this week between the White House and congressional Democrats. They are hoping to have something ready by the State of the Union address a few weeks from now. Meanwhile, we never run out of stories about folks who are dealing with the current healthcare system. According to a recent survey by the Future of Music Coalition, as many as 45% of musicians are uninsured. And that's got 21-year-old aspiring rapper and youth radio reporter Orlando Campbell a tad worried.
Picture this. I'm on stage, the mic clutched tight in my palm, with a sea of waving hands in front of me, and everybody chanting the lyrics to my song. At this moment, the absolute last thing on my mind is health insurance. But recently, on the way home from a concert, something made me think twice about how vulnerable I really am. A drunk driver slammed into my bright purple Buick LeSabre. My car was totaled, but luckily I wasn't injured. And even if I was, I have something most musicians my age don't. Health insurance. This remix was produced by a 28-year-old artist named Trackademics. This song quickly became one of the biggest hits in the San Francisco Bay Area, and it launched his career. To keep up with his concert schedule, Trackademics had to quit his day job. He's been uninsured ever since. He says not having health insurance weighs on him. But at this early point in his career, even if someone handed him $5,000, the money probably wouldn't go to a health plan.
It would probably go more into investing in my career, because it's all about creating opportunity. Once you get the opportunity, you can cash in on the opportunity.
I feel where he's coming from. As a young rapper, I have the same mindset. I need to rent a studio and promote my singles, and that's not cheap. But Trackademics knows investing everything in music and nothing in health is like rolling the dice.
It is a gamble. It is a gamble. And who's to say whether that's smart or not?
Michael Axon is one of those guys who helps artists figure out what's smart. He's an entertainment lawyer and manager in Berkeley, California. He has seen major label contracts with health insurance, just not the type artists find useful.
Buried, and when I say buried, buried in these contracts, you will find these provisions for insurance. And essentially what the labels are doing is they are insuring an asset. You know, are they caring about you as a human being and, you know, we want to make sure you're okay? I'm pretty cynical about that.
Axon says this type of insurance can only be activated at the label's option, which usually means when an artist's health begins to affect the company's profits. If a musician wants to have a baby or go for a routine checkup, they're on their own. R&B singer Angela Beaufield knows what it's like to be on her own with health challenges. Back when Beaufield was at the top of her music game, she sounded like this. But after suffering two severe strokes in 2006 and 7, now she has trouble even speaking.
2 times a stroke survivor. Damaged my vocal cords. No sing no more.
Her career spanned 28 years, and she was signed to major labels like Arista and Capitol Records. But Beaufield never had health insurance. In just the first week after her stroke, her medical bills totaled $100,000. To help with the cost, 3 benefit concerts were organized with big-name performers like Bonnie Raitt and Carlos Santana. The benefits helped, but Beaufield was forced to sell her house to help cover the costs. Now, she lives in a convalescent home in Vallejo, California.
I never expected this to happen. You know, most musicians not think about it.
But some do. That young artist Trackademics thinks about it so much, he came up with a creative solution to at least identify possible health issues.
I'm constantly asking friends who graduated from nursing school, trying to get informal diagnosis, because it's really important for my peace of mind for them to tell me, is this serious? Should I worry about this right now?
What happens when his friends diagnose something serious? Well, he doesn't really have a solution. It's a gamble he feels he has to take. But if it was up to Angela Beaufield, no musician should wait to buy insurance.
Set it up now.
And with all that she's been through, those words are not to be taken lightly. In Oakland, California, I'm Orlando Campbell for Marketplace Money.
That story was produced by Youth Radio as part of their series Generation Invincible about healthcare for young Americans.
Reform was never going to be easy, not with healthcare amounting to 15% of the U.S. economy.
Marketplace Money economics editor Chris Farrell.
There are too many competing interests and too much money at stake. The odds makers didn't even give it a chance. The U.S. has flirted with some kind of national health policy 6 previous times over the past 100 years, only to see the reform impulse wither each time. So, here's why I'm cheering the healthcare bill that's emerged so far. It's much better than the existing system, period. The private insurance industry will abandon the practice of imposing pre-existing conditions on customers. Sure, they'll get millions of new customers and billions in new revenue in return. But if you have health insurance now, you don't need to worry about losing it. And if you don't have health insurance, you'll get covered. Healthcare reform would mark the end of a long erosion in America's social safety net. Think about it. Our pensions, those lucky enough to have one, are less secure than they used to be. Our unemployment insurance system is strained. I could go on, but you get the point. That's why if the president has the opportunity to sign health care reform into law, it will be the most significant improvement in America's safety net since Social Security in 1935 and Medicare in 1965. But I'm going to go out even further on a forecasting limb. It's underappreciated by most commentators, but universal coverage could end up boosting entrepreneurship in America. Thanks to healthcare reform, we could see a supply-side revolution in new business creation over time. Up till now, health insurance has been much too costly while offering far too little coverage for anyone who can't get insurance through an employer. Health reform will remove this major obstacle. Healthcare legislation could also get rid of job lock. That's when folks stay at a job they can't stand because they need to keep their family insured. Yes, the reform effort could still falter. So I can't break out the champagne, but I've got it chilling in the fridge.
Chris Farrell is our economics editor. We'd like to get your thoughts on the healthcare reform effort. Go to marketplace.org and click on contact.
Marketplace Money is supported by Constant Contact, helping small businesses stay connected to their customers with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. Over 300,000 small businesses and nonprofits use ConstantContact.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Remember that credit card overhaul that Congress passed and the president signed last May? Well, big chunks of it are still waiting to go into effect. As of February 22nd, they can't raise your interest rate in the first year your account is open, and they can't change the rate on things you already bought, the balance that's already on the card. We've been seeing lots of credit questions in our inbox, so with me today to help out with some answers is our good friend and MSN Money columnist, Liz Pulliam-Weston. Welcome back, Liz.
Thanks so much, Tess.
You know, this was hailed as a great piece of legislation for consumers, but while we've all been waiting for it to take effect, the banks have decided to just keep socking it to us, haven't they?
Oh, they were busy. They were doubling and tripling people's rates, reducing their credit limits, shutting down inactive accounts. And what was different this time around is they've been doing those things to people with poor credit for a long time.
Right.
But now they were picking on everybody. So a lot of people got, for the first time, a really good look at just how quickly their terms could change.
All right. Well, let's go to the phones and see what kind of pain our listeners are in. Eric in Fullerton, California, called into our listener line after hearing a story that we ran on boomerang children. Those are adults who move back in with mom and dad due to some money trouble. Eric, why are you back in your old room?
Well, because I just could no longer afford to pay rent, and so I had to move back home because the restaurant that I was working at basically just dried up. The clientele was immediately hit by the economic downturn. No one was willing to give up shifts. It became bloodthirsty. I had to make a quick financial decision, and I decided to move back home. I was living in LA, completely independent and very happy, able to still work there at a restaurant and pursue my dream, which is to be an actor. And
wait, you were an actor working in a restaurant?
Nicely done.
Well, I have to ask you, are the Iron Maiden posters still up in your bedroom?
They're not. I've made my wall into a big vision wall. I don't do vision boards. I do vision walls.
Very nice.
And so it's divided into career, health, and relationship. And I do six-month goals, and definitely on one of them is a budget. That's one of my main goals. I just was able to pay off my Best Buy credit card. But,
so what does your wall look like? I mean, do you literally have, like, big pieces of paper?
Yes, I do.
Wow.
I have pictures.
I love that idea.
You know, sports stuff to keep me fit and pictures of ideal women that I'd like to date one day.
Well, which comes first, the women or the straightening out your finances?
It's all a triangle. It's all equal attention should be paid.
Well, so I'm guessing that you're looking for some advice on how to eventually get out of the house.
Oh, my God. Please give me some advice. Because I love my father. I love living at home. The rent is cheap, but still, I'm a grown adult, and I cannot live here any longer.
Understandable, Liz. A tough situation that a lot of people are finding themselves in these days. Any words of advice for Eric?
Well, I want to ask Eric, you said you got the Best Buy card paid off, but it sounded like there was some other debt out there that you were concerned about.
I have about $7,400 on one credit card that needs to just go away.
All right. So, Liz, we have a couple of issues going on here. First of all is the credit card that does have a balance. Eric, did you try to call and get that interest rate lowered?
I haven't yet.
Okay.
I was waiting for your advice.
Liz?
Well, here's the thing. We used to routinely say, call them up, see if you can get a lower interest rate. And what happened in the last year was that really backfired on some people, that the banks were using that as an excuse to review your account. And instead of getting a lower interest rate, they might have increased it. They might have lowered your credit limit. So all of a sudden, everything was up in the air, and we weren't sure what to do for people. Eric, do you know what your credit scores are by any chance?
They're high. They're in the excellent to good range.
Right. If you're in the 740 and up range, you're pretty much golden. You are the candidate or the customer that credit card companies still want. Mm. So, Eric, what I'd recommend is if it is 740 or above, then go on one of the credit card offer sites, cardratings.com, creditcards.com, and look at some of those balance transfer offers to see if you can get a lower rate, because you really do want to get rid of this debt. And one of the first things you got to do is stop using the card.
Yes, and I have since October.
Ah, good, good. That's huge, because you know your patterns have to change. Otherwise, you're going to just keep running in place even with a lower interest rate. If that doesn't work, if you can't find a good balance transfer offer, you might check with your local credit union, because they have 3-year personal loans that would fix your rate. Would be less than you're paying now. It wouldn't be a huge amount less, maybe 15%. But then you'd have an installment-like loan, so you pay it off over 3 years.
So it's not a credit card.
It's not a credit card. It actually is usually pretty good for your scores. But more important, it fixes the rate, fixes the payments, and you can pay it off more quickly if you want.
So, Eric, do you have the money to be paying this off? Do you have a job?
I have a job currently. I'm a restaurant supervisor. It's not nearly as much as when I was serving at another restaurant. I've certainly been looking for a second job on top of it, or for that phone call from Steven Spielberg. Still waiting on one or the other.
We'll keep our fingers crossed for both.
Yeah.
All right, so I have something to add to your vision wall. I want you to make a note that we're going to call you back and see how this all shook out for you.
Okay. When shall I expect?
That's good.
Let's give it a goal. Let's give it maybe 2 or 3 months. Does that
two
give you enough time?
2 or 3 months. Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
Gosh,
great.
I hope so. Okay.
We have confidence in you.
Thank
absolutely.
You so much.
Good luck, Eric.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, with this downturn, we've been noticing not just the children, but the parents of people who are in trouble are writing in. And Ben in Florida is one of those parents. He says his son is in a lot of financial trouble, doesn't seem to quite be taking it seriously. Right, Ben?
That's correct.
Yeah. So what kind of debt has your son gotten himself into?
Probably a total of about $30,000.
Oh.
I'd say 26, 27 is credit card debt.
Does he have a job? Does he have an income?
He has a management position at an auto parts store, which he's had for about 8 months now.
And how old is he?
He's 26 now.
Is this something that you guys talked about when he was a kid? Did you ever talk about money management?
We did. He comes from a divorced family, so my visitation was sporadic with him at best. Part of it is just because I couldn't be involved in his life as much as I wanted to. So we're trying to, he takes it in stride when we do discuss this. It's just... he lacks discipline and motivation to take action, and I've probably lost more sleep over it than him.
Wow.
And I'm not going to pay that kind of debt, and I wouldn't anyway. But I do constantly remind him, have you, done anything with this? He leans towards doing bankruptcy.
Well, Liz, this is a great question about really, first of all,
how you continue to have this conversation with a child who's in trouble, and you know, kind of maybe what would be some first steps that he could take beyond this conversation that doesn't seem to be having an impact on the son.
Well, Ben, first of all, I'm delighted to hear you're not going to be pulling out a checkbook and paying off this debt. I think that's the natural response of a lot of parents. We want to help our kids. We don't want to see them suffer or have any bad consequences. And all that does is teach them to rely on the bank of dad. They don't really learn. I got to say, as a parent, there's only so much you can do. And, you know, you can talk to him about, you know, finding a bankruptcy attorney and talking about his options. You could let him know that there are serious consequences that could come, like lawsuits and judgments and stuff like that. But it really is up to him. I would try to steer him away of any place that promises to settle his debt for pennies on the dollar with no impact on your credit and everything.
Run away.
Good. Yeah. I mean,
that's what I found when I went on the internet. Even some of them, their addresses almost sound like they're government-sponsored programs.
Yeah, there is no government-sponsored debt settlement program, much as we all wish there would be. Government needs to settle its own debt first. But Liz, what about credit counseling? It seems to me that that might be a natural place to start.
Yeah, absolutely. There are legitimate credit counselors. Look for the National Foundation of Credit Counseling. That's nfcc.org. They can, you know, send him to an agency in his area. They can look at his situation, see if they can set up a payment plan.
Sounds like maybe a little tough love, and then maybe you could really help out with a little bit of preliminary research on finding some legitimate credit counseling.
Well, that's what I'll do.
Good luck.
Good luck, Ben.
Good luck to you and your son.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And you can also send us an email. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And we'll be taking more questions from you later in the show, including, Liz, a detective story about tracking down who owns your debt. Keeping a poker face while choosing investments isn't usually necessary, but big bets and bad hands are at the heart of stock markets.
Exactly the same problems, emotional problems that we have in gambling, we have in investing. There's fear, there's greed.
We'll take a look at what Texas Hold'em might teach you about when to fold on Wall Street. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It's one of the oldest cliches in investing. The stock market is just a casino with a ticker. Take just about any game on the loud, smoky, whiskey-soaked floor of a gaming hall, and you've got a metaphor for Wall Street. Slots, roulette, maybe even the ponies. And then there's poker.
$2 stacks of quarters?
Yeah.
Turns out playing poker could actually make you a better investor. So get off the card table, the plastic chips, and your tasty beverage of choice, and get ready for a little Texas Hold'em.
Yeah, this is high-stakes poker, so everybody gets $5 worth of chips.
That's Bob Frick. He writes about investing for Kiplinger's, and his most recent article is How Poker Can Make You a Better Investor. And he recently let us listen in on a pickup game he held with a few buddies in D.C. They could have chosen just about any form of poker, but the favorite was Texas Hold'em.
So here's the moment of truth. All right, Darren, you in?
It's the first of many decisions.
Should I throw in two nickels or one dime?
Okay. This is like your first decision. You've had an investment for a few months, now you get more information, and now you have to decide what you're going to do. See, that's just a nickel, so you know he doesn't have anything. Right? I'm wisely going to fold. All right. So now that's basically... Damn. I wish I'd stayed in. Now I'm kicking myself.
Well, now that he's kicked himself, Bob Frick joins us to further explain why we should all be sitting down to a table of cards and coins before we make our next 401k deposit. Welcome back to the show, Bob.
Hi, Tess.
Annie up, would you?
What are the stakes?
How about $1.50?
How about your entire retirement portfolio?
I could go with that. So let's start with what just happened there. You're in the first hand of the game, and you got out too soon. You are feeling all kinds of regret.
And who couldn't see the parallel on that one, right? What has investing been over the last couple of years, if not full of massive regret?
Right. One of the primary things that you feel in poker, when you lose a hand or you should have stayed in, you get this sinking feeling. And we've all felt that in investing. As it turns out, those feelings are essentially firing off the exact same parts of our brains.
And regret is just one of five common errors that you found in both investing and gambling. And you talk about these all being emotional errors. So are you telling us there's emotion involved in investing?
Well, that's the main problem with investors is we're emotional. And again, the experts have spelled this out so clearly that exactly the same problems, emotional problems that we have in gambling, we have in investing. There's fear, there's greed, and I mean, my idea is that there's a shorthand to teach yourself how not to do these things, and that's by just playing a little Texas Hold'em.
All right, let's head back to the poker game and see how it's going.
Shell?
Yep.
All right, pair of kings.
Told you.
Pair of kings as well.
Yeah. And seven, a seven. Two, all right. Split so you're splitting
pair
the pot.
And three.
Two pair of wins.
If you were nice, if you were nice, the queen on the river, that was nice.
Hanging on.
With the pair of threes, wow.
I don't know what kind of an investment strategy you'd call that.
Yeah, these high
hanging
threes.
On. Seeing what happens.
Bob, is that an investment strategy?
Yeah, well, it is for a lot of people. And the problem is people build up hope about an investment just like you build up hope about a poker hand. And you keep on putting more chips in just like you keep on holding on or even buying more stock because that's going to justify your decision to hold it to begin with. And it's just wishful thinking. And again, it's a very emotional response.
Although, you know, a lot of folks did hold on after the market crash last year, kind of hoping for a rebound, a better hand, so to speak, and they actually got it.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's true. It's not that any of these things is ever wrong all the time. The thing you have to recognize is, for example, the wrong thing was a year ago, February, March, we were at the bottom of the market, and people felt so much pain. People wanted to avoid that pain so much that they cashed out.
Right.
When you can recognize that you're in an emotional situation, that's when you can step back and start thinking logically and basically not screw up.
Well, this concept, of course, is a lot of fun, but can you give us a practical example of how you would avoid making the same mistake both in poker and on Wall Street?
Well, one of the clear things that happens in poker is you're dealt two aces. And when you have a great investment, you think you've got two aces in the hole, and you think nothing's going to beat it. Well, as it turns out, more people lose money on two aces in poker than any other hand.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Once you have those two aces in your hand, you get tunnel vision. You tend not to look at what could go wrong.
Huh.
For example, let's say you've got, you know, two aces, a spade, and a diamond. All of a sudden, four hearts come out, you know, on the board.
Mm-hmm.
And you're thinking, oh, my aces are good, my aces are good. Well, obviously, your aces aren't good anymore because someone's got a flush, which is going
right.
to beat your pair. And the same thing with an investment. We have this great stock, for example, and all of a sudden the CEO gets indicted. Oh, well, that's, you know, well, I'm still going to hold on to that stock. And, oh, it turns out its product causes cancer. Well, that's okay. It's still a great stock. And we tend to hold these things until they nosedive because greed makes us overestimate our odds of success, same as in poker.
And I suppose the theory is that if you sit down and you learn this about yourself in poker, it's going to make it a lot easier for you to recognize when you're doing that on Wall Street.
Yeah, the idea is if you test yourself when you can identify these things, that's the time that you step back with your investments and say, maybe I need to take a breath here and maybe I need to do something logical as opposed to emotional.
Are poker players by nature or by training good investors?
Well, I interviewed a number of poker players for this story, and as it turns out, they are surprisingly conservative investors.
Hmm.
They take their risk at the table, and when they make money, you know, they put it in like muni bonds or you know, annuities or something like that.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Bad poker players play emotionally. Bad investors invest emotionally.
Bob Frick is with Kiplinger's, and his article on poker and investing is currently at kiplingers.com. We'll have a link to that on our website. Bob, do you generally win at poker?
You know, since I started studying this stuff, I actually am one of the usual winners at my, you know, neighborhood poker game, although those guys would never admit it.
All right. Well, then with that, I'm going to fold. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We
We're back with personal finance columnist Liz Pulliam-Weston to answer your questions about money or the lack thereof. Tim in Chicago wrote in with what amounted to a bit of a spicy game of Clue for us. He went delinquent on a credit card through HSBC a while back. HSBC then sold the debt, which happens all the time. And then whoever that was sold the debt to another company, and then it was sold again and again and again. And he did a little bit of detective work, but the trail has gone dead. There's no phone number, no email. He cannot figure this out. Tim, I feel for you.
Yeah, I've been hunting down this debt, and I had let it go for a long time. Like you said, I went delinquent, and I just have finally started trying to get back on my feet and get everything figured out. I'm at a point where I have an address, but I'm not sure if it's the right company or what.
Boy, Liz, I don't know. Colonel Mustard in the study with the candlestick.
Yeah. I mean, most people I talk to are trying to get collection agencies off their back because it's not their debt. Actually, what you can do is start with your credit bureau reports. You have a right to see them, you know, free once a year from annualcreditreport.com.
Have you pulled those?
Well, I did last year. I hadn't really paid attention to it at that time. And now, when I checked, they said I have to wait till the 28th.
Oh, yeah, for your free ones, right. Once a year.
Once you pull those reports, look in the collections and see what's there. I mean, you may have several companies listed for the same debt, or there may just be one that's the current holder of the debt. Dispute those collections, because at least you could get them taken off your credit report if they can't verify the debt.
Oh, interesting.
So that's one thing to think about. Another thing you should keep in mind, if you do track down this debt, is that they probably paid pennies on the dollar, maybe even fractions of pennies on the dollar for this debt. So there's no need for you to pay the full face amount. I mean, they're going to make a profit if you pay anything.
So you can actually dicker with the collection?
Oh, totally.
And what do we mean by everything? What kind of dollar amount are we talking about?
I had some medical bills. I had outstanding credit cards, and I had my student loans. And I've gotten back on top of everything that I know about. But this one still is out there.
What got you started on all this, trying to figure out where this debt went?
Well, I got married last year, and my wife really wanted us to start at zero instead of deeply negative. So
understandable.
Good.
We applaud your wife.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very much so. Well, since these are relatively recent debts, I mean, they don't typically fall off your credit report until 7 years and 180 days after the first delinquency.
So it should say right there what the company is, right? And then what, you can Google them?
There's usually contact information. Okay. If there's not, Googling is the way to go. And like I said, negotiate hard, because anything you pay them is going to be gravy to them. I mean, I would start off offering 10%, 30%, somewhere in that neighborhood, and negotiate from there. Make sure you get it in writing that they're not going to resell the unpaid debt, because that just, you know, lets you in for more of this.
Wait a minute. So that's, you agree to pay less than what they say you owe, and then they resell the rest of it to somebody?
Yes. That,
really?
That is a common practice. So you want writing that this is, you know, settlement in full. And also be prepared for a tax bill, because this forgiven debt is going to be considered income to you.
Okay.
So Tim, the real question is, if and when you do get this cleared up and this mystery is solved, will you have a blank slate, you and your wife?
I believe I will.
All right. So maybe we'll check back in with you a little later on, and perhaps we could have a bit of a chat with your wife as well.
Maybe so, yeah.
Okay. He's about to change his number on this.
Well, you are on your way, so congratulations to both of you, and we'll check back in later on.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tim.
Take care.
Bye. All right, Liz, our last caller is Jill, and she's in Kalamazoo, Michigan. I love the name of that city.
Absolutely.
And, of course, now I'm going to start singing. Well, no, actually.
I think I've heard that song quite a few times, actually.
Really? So I understand you're a little overwhelmed with your credit card debt as well, just like Tim?
I am. My situation is, I have a Visa card. I had my credit union buy that debt, I guess is what you would call it, and it's close to $10,000. And my question is, I have three different accounts, retirement accounts, I guess. So my question is, you know, I would like to get that $10,000 out of my life. Does it make sense to take the money from the rollover IRA and pay it off?
Well, you have these retirement plans, so obviously you have a job.
Is that,
and is it not providing enough where you could pay it off just through your paycheck?
Pretty much not. I mean, the cost of living has just gone up all around. I have a daughter in college.
Let me ask you, Jill, about your daughter in college. You're helping her with all of her expenses, some of her expenses. How does that work?
Some of them.
Okay. And how are you doing that? Is that out of your current income? Are you putting that on the cards? Or where's
Well,
that?
No, I haven't been putting it on the card. I've actually was taking it out, some of it out on the IRA.
Okay. Right. Stop that.
Yeah, I did. I have.
Okay.
I have done
that. All right. I know it's so tempting when you have that money just sitting there that, you know, you want to scoop it up, the money that's in a retirement account. The problem with that is even when it's not penalized, you're paying taxes. But even worse, you're losing all the future tax-deferred returns you could make on that money.
Liz, give us an example of how that works, because we say that all the time on this program, that you take money out of your retirement account, it's going to take forever for you to make that up, and you're losing all this gain. But that's kind of an amorphous idea.
Yeah.
What kind of money are we talking about?
Well, Jill, may I ask how old you are?
I'm a baby boomer.
Okay.
So 60 or so, early 60s?
No, in my 50s.
In the 50s. Okay. The standard thing I tell people is if you have 30 years before you tap the money, every $1,000 you take out is going to cost you $10,000 in lost retirement income. And that's conservative, okay? And, you know, in your age bracket, the damage is probably going to be a little bit less, but it's still significant, you know? And the thing is, you cannot put that money back. Once it's out, it's out for good. Really, the best way to pay off this debt is not to dip into, you know, a retirement fund. It's to pay it out of current income. And the best way to do that is to look at everything you're spending and figure out ways to trim your current budget. It's no fun. It may mean taking a step back in your lifestyle, but that's really the way to get this debt taken care of.
It will be difficult, but it does make sense.
You do want to retire someday, so keep that fund intact.
Oh, you're right. I will. All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call.
Okay. Bye.
Liz, is there any circumstance under which you would recommend that someone go ahead and tap the retirement account?
Your child has an operation that insurance won't cover, and it's life-threatening. I mean, really, it should be those kind of life and death issues, because we're all going to, or most of us, like 80% of us or more, are going to get to retirement age.
Right.
We're going to need this money. You want to start as early as possible, save as much as you can, and not stop and not go backwards by cashing out what you've got.
All right, folks, you heard it here. Leave the retirement fund alone. Liz, thanks so much for helping out. We'll give you all the credit for this part of the show.
Delighted. Thanks, Tess.
All right. We're here to take your money questions anytime. Do call us. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or send us an email. You can do that with the Getting Personal link at our website. It's marketplace.org. And next week, we're going to be taking your questions about investing. So if you are flummoxed by stocks and bonds and PE ratios and the like, go ahead and write to us. And remember to always check with your financial professional before you make any big money decisions. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. And finally, some financial advice that, while you may have seen it all week in various media, bears repeating here. The unthinkable tragedy that befell the citizens of Haiti has most, if not all of us, asking, what can I do to help?
The best and most effective way to give in these kinds of situations is to give cash to an organization on the ground.
Ian Moncaster is with the World Affairs Council in Seattle, and we asked him to talk about how and where our urge to give can make the most difference right now.
The immediate needs for relief are critical. So you need someone who's got staff there, who speaks the language, and can start putting your money to work the next day.
And which organizations can do that? Well, he says the big names you know are the ones with systems in place for this kind of crisis. The Red Cross, World Vision, CARE. But while it's important that aid gets to the country quickly, the earthquake's aftermath will take months, if not years, to sort out. If you can't afford to donate money now, there are other options.
There are lots of different ways, I think, in which you can help. If you yourself don't have the resources, are you willing to work with a community group and go knock on doors and say, we're raising money for this organization that's working in Haiti, and this is why we think it's important?
Of course, anytime there's a massive aid effort like this, there's always the danger that people will try to profit by posing as charitable organizations.
There are people who are going to try and scam, absolutely. I think you can use the internet to verify a lot. If someone comes to your door and says, I'm raising money for poor Haitians, say, give me the website. Let me look it on the website, and I can donate online. But the bottom line is that people in Haiti need help now. You know, in many respects there, but for the grace of God, go you and I.
He mentions the internet, and you may also have heard that one bright spot in all of this is the huge sum of money raised through text messaging. Millions and millions in relief money, most of it from people donating no more than $10. And just about every charity will tell you every penny adds up.
The ocean's made up of lots and lots and lots of little drops of water. No matter what it is, it makes a difference.
We've got links to more information on how you can donate on our website. It's marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, when it comes to shopping in China, there's safety in numbers. Vendors don't stand a chance against 200 unified bargain hunters.
A lot of the clothing stores, you can bargain the price. And even at the big department stores, those sort of Best Buy type of retailers, you can usually get the price down a little bit.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman, Eve Tro, and Jolie Myers. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tessa Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org. Or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, working to solve America's retirement savings challenge through innovation, service, and performance. Putnam, a world of investing.
American Public Media.